Welcome to Darwin at the LSE. We're setting the intellectual agenda tonight by celebrating the launch of a series of small and perfectly formed books, Darwinism Today, for those with short attention spans, 8,000 words. And we're very privileged to have three of the authors of the first four books with us this evening. I'll just tell you very quickly the form of the evening. I'm going to just make a few introductory remarks for about 3 or 4 minutes. Then I'll introduce the speakers, who are going to talk for about 15 minutes each. There's then going to be a general discussion. I think that should last about an hour. And then we go over to the students' cafe to settle our differences or drown our sorrows. What I'd like to say initially is that in another intellectual climate, one that prevailed, say, a mere 15 years ago, I think it would have been necessary for me to apologize for my presence as a novelist chairing a meeting of scientists. It would not only have been presumptuous, but intellectually impossible. It wasn't so long ago that in describing the essence of science, one took, as a matter of course, the dominant model as physics, rooted in hypotheses and prediction, deeply counterintuitive where relativity and quantum mechanics are concerned, entangled in the arcana of difficult mathematics, and indeed generally illustrative of that as yet unexplained mystery as to why the physical world can be described at all in terms of laws that have mathematical expression. Thanks to the lifetime's work of a writer like Ernst Mayr, we no longer have to accept physics as the only true model of science. Many branches of science are not or are not only predictive, but by their very nature, historical, like astronomy and paleontology. Even more are essentially descriptive. The historical and the descriptive necessarily bring the scientist some little way in the domain of the humanities and to the turbulent interfaces with the social sciences. However, lately it's gone a lot further than that, and boundaries have been dissolving. To put it mildly, an incursion has been going on. A long and thoughtful conversation amongst those who are, in E.O. Wilson's phrase, unencumbered by a scientific education, has been rudely interrupted. I'm referring here, of course, to the growth of biological thought. Matters which scientists denied themselves not so long ago are now central to their concerns: consciousness, human nature, religion and the roots of morality, hierarchies and the distribution of power. These are all matters which novelists and poets have addressed for many years, and it is for this reason that I make no apology for being here tonight. In gathering here, we confirm what Anglican bishops were always denying they believed when secretly they knew it was true. There is a God in the sky with a big white beard. Unlike the capricious, jealous gods of Homer or the vengeful monster of the Old Testament, we find in Charles Darwin a God of evanescent humility. His parsimonious theory of natural selection has generated a wondrous complexity of study. The effectiveness of this theory, however, was not fully realized until the 30s and 40s with the modern synthesis. And now that power has been unleashed in the form of a slow-gathering intellectual revolution. From the intricacies of a single cell, the action of a single gene, to the nature of language and the complexities of brain function, all these are enfolded within the understanding that as biological processes or entities, they are the products of evolutionary pressure. The orthodoxies of standard social science models are under heavy attack, as is environmental determinism generally. The extent of biology's explanatory reach is already long and a source of wonder. However, in the first flush of triumph, some overreach is inevitable. In the past 5 years, one has been able to read an adaptionist account of every conceivable human impulse and predilection with little scope for the old-fashioned virtues of scientific method, repeatability or falsifiability. No doubt some explanations will be withdrawn or redefined or dismissed in the face of counter-arguments or thoughtful skepticism, for such, we hope, is the nature of science. Downright hostility will, as ever, be insufficient. There can be no doubt that in the past 20 years, we've lived through a heroic age of biological thought. And since it does not seem to be over yet, its practitioners may do well to remember the humility of their first hero. those of us who are not scientists have learned a great deal. It's no longer acceptable to lay claim to an education or a culture while professing ignorance of science. However, now that science has extended its domain and declares its right to speak of human nature, it too has acquired reciprocal and grave responsibilities to attend to the centuries of unbroken thought on this very matter. It's no accident that some of our best writers on science, Steven Weinberg, Richard Feynman, Richard Dawkins, E.O. Wilson, are all highly literate. So it's right that we should have to bear in mind what the Bible or Tolstoy, as well as Ovid or Hardy or Cobbett, have to say about farming, or what Jane Austen teaches us about the mental contortions adopted by women denied work, public position, or property in marriage. This is my sly way of introducing our panel. John Maynard Smith is Emeritus Professor of Biology at the University of Sussex and preeminent among scientists. His publications include The Theory of Evolution, 1958, although that was revised through the years, Mathematical Ideas in Biology in 1968, The Problems of Biology in 1985, and the title of his book for the Darwinism Today series is Shaping Life, Genes, Embryos, and Evolution. Kingsley Brown is Professor of Law at Wayne State University at Michigan. He has a background, too, in physical anthropology, and his numerous publications have brought to bear biological and evolutionary thinking to a range of legal and moral issues. His contribution to the series is entitled Divided Labors, An Evolutionary View of Women at Work. Also joining us a little later for the open discussion will be Geoffrey Miller, who is Principal Research Fellow at the Centre for Economic Learning and Social Evolution at University College London. And among his many academic interests are the evolution of human behaviour, the psychology of economic behaviour, and human mental evolution. Colin Tudge is our first speaker this evening. He read zoology and English at Cambridge in the 60s, then became a writer mainly on matters of evolution, genetics, agriculture, and wildlife conservation. His books include The Famine Business, The Engineer in the Garden, and The Day Before Yesterday. He is currently a research fellow at the LSE Center for Philosophy. His title for the Darwinism Today series is Neanderthals, Bandits, and Farmers, How Agriculture Really Began.
Hello, can you hear? Does this work? No, sorry. Right, that works, doesn't it? Yes, good. About 40 years ago, which doesn't really seem very long anymore to me, paleoanthropologists were quite fond of saying that the subfamily Hominini, which includes the genus Homo, which is us, and the Australopithecines and the other related types, divided from the apes round about 30 million years ago, an extraordinary long time ago. And I remember somebody commenting at the time that it was as if these people accepted Darwin's suggestion that human beings and apes shared a common ancestor, but they wanted to put as great a distance as possible between the two. So they suggested that we'd been evolving separately from them for about 30 million years. And then about 20, 30 years ago, molecular evidence began to come on board, and people said, no, it can't be 30 million years ago that we separated. It must have been nearer 3 million years ago, and this threw a tremendous spanner into the works. But in the end, the molecular biologists have more or less won, and now most people say, well, human beings and the apes, now represented by chimps and gorillas, probably separated only about 5 million years ago, 7 at the most. So the total history of human beings has gone from that long to about that long in over the last 40 years. However, about 40 years ago too, archaeologists were more or less agreed, more or less took it for granted, that agriculture began round about 10,000 years ago, very, very recently in other words, and that before 10,000 years ago, nothing. And then, 10,000 years ago, this huge change known as the Neolithic Revolution, followed by agricultural human beings. Now, what I want to argue, and it's not entirely an original thesis, if it was, I'd be quite worried about it, because that would mean that nobody else would agree with it, but I want to argue more strongly, I think, than it's been argued in the past, that agriculture really began, well, something that one might reasonably call proto-farming probably began about 40,000 years ago. And although it wasn't agriculture in a sense that one could now recognize, it was land management and species management of a degree which made a very, very significant difference to the ecological success of the human beings who were practicing it, and a very, very considerable impact on the other species. In other words, it was when we really seriously started practicing proto-farming 40,000 years ago that we really became modern and we really started affecting everything else. If you take this sort of later date, the earlier date, 40,000 years ago, as being the start of agriculture, then a lot of things that hitherto were actually very, very difficult to explain become very, very easy to explain. In fact, they just fall into place. And the first thing I think that becomes quite easy to explain, if you take the early date of agriculture, is actually the extinction of the Neanderthals. Because the Neanderthals and modern human beings lived side by side in Europe for at least 10,000 years, and in the Middle East for a great deal longer than that. And then apparently suddenly, round about 30,000 years ago, the Neanderthals just finally disappeared. Spain seems to have been one of their last strongholds. That's quite easy to explain if you think that the modern human beings were already practicing farming. The other phenomenon which I think is easier to explain if you take the early date for farming is what's known as the Pleistocene overkill. And the Pleistocene overkill was the sudden collapse of about 80% of the large mammals in the world outside Africa and Eurasia. After about 18,000 years ago, going on a huge massive extinctions in North America and South America around about 13 to 11,000 years ago, and a whole series of extinctions after that, stretching right up really until the 17th century in places like Hawaii. And this, obviously that extends beyond the Pleistocene, but let's call that the Pleistocene overkill. Again, I find that easy to explain if you take the early date of farming as being the right one. And the third phenomenon I think is easy to explain if you take the early date is why it is that after farming began in the Middle East around 10,000 years ago, it started springing up in all sorts of other places like the Indus Valley and India and China and various parts of America at sort of a few thousand year intervals after 10,000 years ago. Again, if you take the early date, this all fits very neatly. Excuse me. So the first part of what I want to say is that the early date is the right one, and it explains a lot. The second thing I want to discuss is what the Neolithic Revolution really was, if it wasn't actually the beginning of agriculture, because I think it was still obviously something very, very significant and was the beginning of something big, but it wasn't the beginning of agriculture per se. So that's the second thing I want to discuss. And the third thing I want to discuss, which really does take us into the realms of evolutionary psychology, is the notion that we have actually inherited a number of attitudes that go with being a proto-farmer or go with being a proper farmer of the kind that was around after the Neolithic Revolution, and that these attitudes which we developed, which were adaptations in those days, are no longer, as it were, relevant or apt for our present way of life. And in particular, we developed in those days what is generally known as the Puritan work ethic. And I don't think it's the Puritan work ethic at all. I think it's the agricultural work ethic. And I think actually there's a good reason for thinking that it's now, as it were, non-adaptationist anymore. It's actually rather counterproductive. And that one of the great challenges for the 21st century and beyond, or one of the great challenges for a post-technological society, is to learn again how to be lazy. Because one of the remarkable features of all big predators, all big predatory animals, is that they are incredibly lazy. And we are big predatory animals. And yet we work, you know, we work and work and work. At least some people do. But I mean, that's the idea. That's what you're supposed to do. And this is extraordinary. It's sort of non-biological. It's peculiar. And I think it's an adaptation to farming, which, as I say, is no longer appropriate. Let's just take the notion, first of all, that we did begin farming 40,000 years ago and not 10,000 years ago. What's the evidence for it? The answer is there isn't any. It's all sort of post hoc. One says explanations work if you assume this, and they don't work if you don't. But let's be a bit sensible about this. The thing is that people assume that the relationship between a predator and its prey is always, as it were, destructive. In other words, when the predator gets really stuck in, the prey starts to dwindle, diminish. And you see these sort of textbook representations of the prey increasing, and then the predators increase, and then the prey falls off, and then the predators fall off in their wake, and always the predators are seen as diminishing the prey. Well, that is obviously part of the story, but another part of the story, which is at least equally interesting, is that a lot of creatures actually propagate the very species that they prey upon. And they do this in all kinds of ways. I mean, I'm impressed by coral reef fish, for example, which guard algae on coral reefs. I mean, this is crop protection. And it undoubtedly changes the genetics of the algae because they no longer need to put up their own defenses because they've got fishes doing it for them. And there are lots of examples of this kind. Or there is propagation, direct propagation. For example, if you take orangutans out of a forest, then the variety of fruits diminishes. Or if you take fruit bats out of a forest, then the variety of fruits diminishes. And why is that? I mean, the fruit bats and the orangs are preying upon the fruit, but the point is by preying upon the fruit, they actually spread the seeds and they propagate the fruit. And it seems to me that the relationship between predator and prey is often much more subtle than it's been presented as being. And it seems to me that human beings, and this is, let's say, the very beginning of our own genus Homo, 2.2 million years ago, we were certainly predatory animals. I mean, all the evidence said we were predatory animals, but I think there's probably, well, we were preying on animals and we were preying on plants, but it seems to me to be quite a good reason for suggesting that we weren't simply attacking and diminishing the creatures that we were preying upon, that we were actually in various ways helping to propagate the species that we were preying upon. And one way in which you would do this would again be the simple business of crop protection. If there was a grove of fruiting trees that the early hominines liked, one could imagine that they would have driven other creatures away and encouraged these things to grow. Or one can imagine that they would indeed have spread the seeds of the plants that they favored in exactly the same way that the orangutans do today. Now, what it seems to me is that one can talk about this hunting, gathering, propagative kind of activity developing into proto-farming as really in parallel with human beings becoming conscious. I mean, the real difference is not that one minute we're not propagating seeds, the next minute we are. The real point is that at some point in history we are propagating seeds, but at some point later we are conscious that we are propagating seeds and actually start to do it as a matter of course. Now, what I want to suggest is that if you look at the archaeological evidence, you see in the late Paleolithic, about 40,000 years ago, a tremendous takeoff in the culture of human beings, a terrific sort of increase in the variety of their tools and so on. Many people have said this is when the beginning of modern consciousness dawned. I mean, it's a vague term, but let's leave it at that for the time being. And all I'm suggesting is that this is consciousness being superimposed on a kind of propagative activity that was there already. So saying that sort of farming began 40,000 years ago is not so revolutionary as it may seem. Now, when you want to say, then, what was the Neolithic Revolution? Because there is no doubt that 10,000 years ago in the Middle East, you suddenly start seeing huge sort of caches, consignments of seeds being stored in the ground. That in itself is not so significant because you could have gathered the seeds and put them into a store. But what is significant is that you begin to see that these seeds are actually different from the wild seeds. In other words, they've been genetically altered by virtue of being domesticated to some extent. And people say, well, this is the beginning of agriculture. What I want to say, no, this is actually the beginning of large-scale agriculture. This is the beginning of people farming on such a scale that it shows up in the archaeological record. And the thing about archaeology, as with paleontology, is that when you find something, it's very, very rare to find anything being left behind at all, whether it's an artifact or whether it's a fossil. So if you do find anything, you can make two reasonable assumptions. One is that that activity or that thing is already common, and two, that it's probably already been around for a long time because it couldn't have been common from day one. So what you're seeing in 10,000 years ago is the beginning of agriculture that really was practiced on such a large scale that you can see it remaining in the archaeological record. Now then the question arises, well actually I've only got 5 minutes so I'm not going to tell you what that question is, but let's just jump on to this next point about the Pleistocene overkill, this terrific extinction of big animals after about 20,000 years ago. Difficult to explain in normal terms because normally if hunters find it difficult to drive animals to extinction because if they really do diminish the population of a given animal, then they stop hunting it because it's no longer cost effective to do so. And yet it seems as if human beings hunted species after species to extinction. Now I think that's easy to explain if you say, well, the people who did it were already farming because, you know, animals that farm, or no, no, well, human beings that farm are more dangerous as predators than people who don't farm, because they've already got all the food that they need, and then they are not worried by the fact that that particular species of prey are being diminished. You see what I mean? It's like domestic cats. Domestic cats are much more dangerous to wildlife than wild cats, because they're being fed on kitty cat. And so if they wipe out the local sparrows, it doesn't matter. The cats remain. They feed on kitty cat till the sparrows come back, and then they hit them again. And it's the same with human beings. If you're farming, you can be a much more dangerous predator than you can if you're not farming. Right.
Thank you, Colin Tudge.
I haven't finished yet.
Oh, sorry. take more. Sorry, I took that pause for a kind of falling sound.
That pause was thirst. I just want to. There are two quick points I want to make before I stop. One is, I want to draw attention to the very big difference between the different kinds of farming. There's horticulture on the one hand. There's pastoralism on the other hand, where you're chasing, where you're sort of herding sheep and goats and that kind of stuff. And the really big and serious farming is arable farming, which is the only one where you really break up the ground and you start again with a clean slate and you actually plant your crops. There's a reference to this, a very obvious reference to this in the Bible, in the myth of Cain and Abel, where one has to recall that Cain, who is the one who is looked down upon and who is regarded as the dangerous one, is the arable farmer. And Abel, who is the chap who gets killed and is seen to be jolly gentle and nice, is the pastoral farmer who keeps sheep. The significance of this, I'm quite sure, is that Abel, as a pastoralist, was seen actually to be, he is not a man who destroys landscape, he's not a man who destroys way of life. Whereas arable farming is an extremely aggressive thing. Once you start plowing the land, then you break up the habitats, and then you actually have a serious impact on the landscape as a whole. Now I get to the real point. But once you start arable farming, once you start any kind of farming, the whole point of farming is that you increase the amount of food that's available to you. You increase the amount of food above what the unmanaged landscape would normally produce. Once you start doing that, you raise the possibility that you will increase the population of your own population over and above what the unmanaged landscape could support. Once you start doing that, then you're obliged to go on farming in order to support the raised population. So once you start farming on a serious level, you get yourself into a kind of vicious spiral or ascending spiral. The more you farm, the more you have to farm, because the more your population goes up. That's one point. The second point is that if you're a hunter, it doesn't actually pay you to increase your activity particularly. If you're a lion, for example, and you decide to hunt all day rather than just hunting for a couple of hours a day, which is what they normally do, this would be severely counterproductive very quickly, because you'd very soon run into problems of injury and fatigue. And that's why you find that large predators are, in general, very, very minimalist. They do the absolute minimum they need to do in order to stay alive. This is not true of farming. This is a complete change of a strategy. With farming, the more work you put in, the more food you'll get. There isn't this sort of law of diminishing, well, there is a law of diminishing returns, but it doesn't operate in anything like the same way as it does with a normal hunter. So you have the two things. First of all, you need to work harder in order to support your rising population. And secondly, it pays you to work harder, which it didn't do before. Now, my final contention is that we developed by whatever means, and we adapted ourselves to farming. We adopted, in fact, quite simply, the work ethic. It paid us to work very, very hard 40,000 years ago onwards, which it hadn't paid our ancestors to do. And we've inherited this way of working. We now have an economy which is based on working as hard as we possibly can. However, once you live in a post-technological society where the machines do the work, and once you live in a world where there's actually we can begin to see the limits of the natural resources, then you can see that this tremendous input actually becomes counterproductive. So the final thesis is that we should readapt to the present reality, and readapting to the present reality means working less hard rather than working more hard. Thank you very much.
Well, a superb exhortation. Professor John Maynard Smith.
Again, I just want to check that I'm audible. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
terrible catch-22, because if you can't, you wouldn't tell me, would you? About 15 years ago, I wrote a book called The Problems of Biology, in which I tried to discuss the bits of biology where we were really in difficulties, we were really stuck. And the two main areas that I discussed, therefore, were first, the problem of how an egg...
I'm having trouble hearing you at the back, because we've got the air conditioning...
Oh, okay. Is that a bit better? That's better. Fine. And please tell me again if I relax, because it's awfully easy to back off. Right, thank you. The first area of difficulty was the problem of how an egg turns into an adult organism. That is the problem of development. And the second area was the problem of how the brain works, how it generates behavior and so on. If I wrote a comparable book today, I would treat the first problem, the problem of how an egg turns into an adult organism, as a problem that is in the course of being solved. It is, to me, far and away the most exciting thing that is happening in biological sciences centrally, is that at last we are beginning to understand development. This fact, I think, hasn't filtered out to the general public very much, essentially because it's very hard work to do it, and the people who are doing it are far too busy doing it to tell the rest of us what they're up to. Since I'm not actively engaged in the enterprise, I can read about it and tell you about it. The revolution depends essentially upon advances in technique and in genetic technique. Nowadays, it's possible to discover genes which play some crucial role in development, to sequence them, to find out when and where they're active in the developing egg, to knock them out and see what goes wrong with the animal, to put them somewhere else in the animal and see what they do, to even to put them into quite unrelated animals and see what they do. And these techniques have made it possible to answer all sorts of questions which remained unsolved until comparatively recently. And because it is a technical problem, I'm very briefly going to describe two experiments. The first is a classic experiment by Walter Gehring and his colleagues in Basel. There is in the mouse a gene called small I. If you have a mutant in this gene, in the mouse, not you, if there exists a mutant in this gene, then the mouse doesn't have any eyes. What that means, of course, is that the normal function of the gene is to play some crucial role in making the eye. And when you knock out that crucial role, the mouse doesn't get an eye. What Gehring did was to take a copy of that gene, put it into a fruit fly, a Drosophila, and arrange for it to be activated, to be switched on, if you like, in various unexpected parts of the fly's body. If you activate that gene halfway down the fly's leg, it grows an eye halfway down its leg. It doesn't, of course, grow a mouse eye. It grows a fly eye with a compound eye with little facets and so on. But it does grow an eye. Now, that is actually a rather astonishing fact when you come to think about it. What it's telling us, in brief, is that the common ancestor of mouse and fly, 500 million years ago, or perhaps a bit more, had the ancestor of this gene. And it was doing something. It wasn't actually making an eye, because that common ancestor didn't have an eye. But it may have had a light-sensitive spot, or a couple of sensitive spots, just a cell or two on its head. And what the gene was doing was saying, come on, chaps, make a light-sensitive spot here. Today, what the gene is doing, again, it's not making an eye. That's being done by a whole series of genes switched on by this master switch. But it's sending out the message, make an eye here. And it does this by switching on other genes, which switch on yet other genes, is a kind of cascade of genes being switched on, and we know what some of these are. The astonishing thing is that it should have been the sequence, the actual structure of that gene, should have been conserved in evolution in these two independent lineages for 500 million years. The conservatism is astonishing. Let me give you one other example, which amuses me for historical reasons. There is an early egg has to know which is going to be its back and which is going to be its belly. You know, it's got to have a top and a bottom. In vertebrates, there is a gene whose activity is dorsal along the surface of the egg that is going to be its back, and it switches on all sorts of dorsal structures, including the formation of the nerve cord, which, as you know, runs along your back. There is a homologous gene, a similar gene in insects, which also tells the animal which way up it is, but when it's active, it switches on the ventral structures of the fly. And as you probably know, the great difference between insects and vertebrates is that we have our nervous system along our backs, and insects and other invertebrates have their nervous system along their bellies. But by transferring the gene and the gene products from insect to mouse or from mouse to insect, you can indeed show that effectively it's the same signal which is telling an egg in a vertebrate be the back and an insect be the belly. The reason why that's historically amusing is that back in 1830, there was a great debate at the French Academy between two famous anatomists, of whom one was Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire. Geoffroy wanted to argue that you could draw parallels between the forms, the morphology, of all animals. But he got real stuck trying to explain the analogies between the form, or the similarities between the form of insects, well, between vertebrates and all the other guys. Because vertebrates, as I say, have got their nervous system along their backs, where it shouldn't be. And Geoffroy said, well, it's quite simple, really. It's just vertebrates or insects upside down. And I was taught this when I was a zoology student back in late 1940s as an illustration of just how stupid scientists in the past could be. And I've said this before, but it's true, particularly if they were French. Well, it looks as if Geoffroy may have been right. It does really look as if maybe vertebrates are descended from, not from an insect, of course, but from some worm-like creature which decided to swim about upside down. And there are, of course, today animals that decide to swim about upside down. These are the kinds of experiments that we are now being able to do. I couldn't do them to save my lives, you understand, but you know, clever people can do these things. The conservatism, of course, is important for an evolutionary biologist because it gives us clues about evolution which we would find it very hard to get any other way, like the idea that maybe vertebrates are worms upside down. It has another and more general importance. It's a sad fact about evolutionary biology at the moment, and has been actually more or less continuously, the whole of this century pretty well, that there's almost no communication between paleontologists on the one hand who study the actual fossil record and people who study existing organisms, either their genetics or their ecology or what have you. We just don't talk to one another. Partly this is due to the fact that we are trained in different places. Paleontologists tend to get trained in departments of ecology, of geology. But essentially it's because we really wouldn't have anything to say to one another if we did talk to one another. You see, paleontology is a study of the change of morphology with time, of form with time. And population genetics, which is my trade, if you like, is the study of changes in the frequency of genes under selection and for other reasons in populations. If you don't know how a change in a gene alters morphology, the two subjects are completely uncoupled. If we develop, as we are now doing, a theory of development based, and in particular, a study of how genes influence morphology, then we will actually have something to say to paleontologists and they will have something to say to us. But it's going to be a very hard gap to bridge, I think. That's the picture that a geneticist would put to you. There is an alternative picture of development being developed by mathematicians and physicists who have noticed, quite correctly, that even in the absence of a living organism, very striking forms can be generated. The stripes on a zebra, the shape of a snowflake, and so on. And are searching for parallels between these dynamic processes, or as they sometimes call them, self-organized processes, and the processes that go on in an embryo. Now, it's very striking, again, that very little communication is going on between these two groups of people. We're terribly... Yeah.
I think we're losing you again.
You're losing me again. Is that better?
Yeah.
It's very striking how little communication is going on between people in sort of dynamical systems, mathematics, and people in developmental genetics. Again, I hope that such communication will start. I believe it's necessary. I think both schools have actually got something to contribute. But it's hard to persuade them that the other guys are worth talking to. A curious twist to this story, and this is the last point I want really to comment on, is that there's a curious ideological association between these two schools of thought. People who think in terms of self-organized structures, of dynamical systems, and so on, tend to be politically of the left. You know, holism is sort of, you know, good radical stuff, nobody's governing you. I don't wish to assert that developmental geneticists all voted for Mrs. Thatcher. I mean, I think of myself as a reductionist, but I assure you I do not vote for her or her descendants. But nevertheless, there is a considerable ideological association. And curiously, it extends also to feminists. I was fascinated to discover that Evelyn Fox Keller, who is an American feminist writer on science, and a very good one, very interesting, identifies reductionist molecular genetic approaches with male domination of nature. And she sees this as a kind of real parallel. Now, of course, scientists have ideologies. I mean, we would be very odd animals if we didn't. And these ideological beliefs do influence the sort of experiments we do. In the dim and distant past, when I was a young Marxist, I actually spent about a year of my life trying to demonstrate experimentally the inheritance of an acquired character. At least I was honest enough not to claim that I'd discovered it, but at least I did try, and that indicates that one's beliefs influence the kind of science you do. I don't actually think it's either I don't think it's avoidable. Of course, our political, religious, philosophical presuppositions are going to influence the kind of science we do. I don't actually think it matters. If, you know, I took an extreme sort of postmodernist view, I would argue, well, this demonstrates that science is all relative, it's a social construct, it's no particular grounds for believing that it's true, it's just a social construct. What that argument misses is that scientific theories are, like organisms actually, exposed to natural selection. Scientific theories which are successfully explain the real world survive. Scientific theories which manage to explain nothing do not. So I don't think it terribly matters if we're influenced in the sort of ideas we pursue by all sorts of totally irrelevant religious and political beliefs. It's hard to avoid that. What is important is that we try to remain reasonably honest when we publish our experimental results, and that there's a sufficient variety of ideas out there that selection of the best ideas will actually ultimately lead to the truth.
Thank you. Can you hear me in the back? Great. Imagine a world in which women had a virtual monopoly on political power, where women outcompeted men in quest for positions of high status, where women, upon giving birth, left their babies at home with their husbands, and where the Army, Air Force, and Marines were made up mostly of women. For those raised on the assumptions of standard social science, this utopia could conceivably come to pass. For them, the primary obstacles to achieving it would be arbitrary cultural beliefs about the two sexes and patriarchal social institutions. For those who believe that human psychology is a product of eons of evolutionary history, however, this hypothetical world is simply incompatible with our innate psychology, no more likely to occur than a population of pigs deciding to sprout wings and fly. It will come as no surprise to this audience here for the launch of the Darwinism Today series that humans, like all other animals, are products of natural selection, a process that shapes not only the bodies of animals, but also their minds. Natural selection, specifically sexual selection, has shaped the human mind to create a human nature. In fact, in some ways, it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that it's shaped two natures, a male nature and a female nature. While these two natures overlap significantly, the differences reveal themselves in certain temperamental traits. And as I'll discuss in a few minutes, sex differences in these traits have substantial workplace outcomes. The reason that the sexes differ in temperament is that different traits have been advantageous to the reproductive success of members of the two sexes. A characteristic feature of mammalian reproduction is that the female must invest substantial physiological resources in offspring during both pregnancy and nursing. The minimum necessary investment of the male, however, involves participation in a single sexual encounter, a burden, as we know, that men are all too willing to shoulder. Thus, a male can enhance his reproductive success by acquiring multiple mates in a way that a female cannot. Put simply, a man with 20 wives will have many children. A woman with 20 husbands will have no more than a woman with one husband, and given what we know about male sexual jealousy, will probably end up dead and with no children at all. The corollary of some men's ability to reproduce with multiple mates is that some may be excluded completely from the process of reproduction. This fact places an enormous premium on a man's ability to make himself a credible player in the mating game. The stakes are high because all men have a similar interest. The question then is, what distinguishes the successful male from the unsuccessful male? I think I'm being censored here. That question, in turn, requires an analysis of what the female needs from the male. In some mammals, such as deer, the female doesn't need much at all. Once the male has inseminated the female, she has no further use for him. There may be some human females who feel that way, too. But the long period of dependency of human young creates substantial pressure for male post-conception investment. So the woman, from time immemorial, has looked to her mate for provisioning and protection. Who can provide those things? Obviously, it must be someone with both the ability and the inclination to do so. Therefore, for a woman, important attributes of a mate are status and resources, and of course, a willingness to share those resources. Although the correlates of male status differ somewhat from culture to culture, for much of our evolutionary history, status has depended on skill as a hunter and warrior and on the capacity to influence others through either personality or by force. Because the quest for status entails competition with other men, men are predisposed to engage in the competitive, risky, and aggressive behaviors that may be required to attain it. Women, on the other hand, would generally gain no reproductive advantage through open competition for status or from exposing themselves to substantial risks. Instead, they've enhanced their reproductive success by providing direct care for their offspring, probably accounting for the stronger bond between mother and infant than typically exists between father and infant. The proximate mechanism for many of these sex differences in psychology is the action of hormones. Hormones manufactured by the male fetus cause its brain as well as its body to develop in a male direction, and differential hormonal exposure throughout postnatal life, especially at and after puberty, enhances the difference. These hormones produce a male mind more oriented toward risk, aggression, and competition, just as they produce a male anatomy that is larger, hairier, and more muscular. Females who are exposed to the hormones typically experienced by males tend to be more male-like in their behaviors, often being tomboys in their youths and competitive women in adulthood. Now, let me emphasize a critical point here. When I'm speaking of differences between the sexes, I'm talking about average differences. Many individuals don't match the stereotype, just as many individuals don't satisfy the generalization that men are taller than women. But average differences between the groups are relevant to group differences in outcome. Participants in an activity, for example, that put a premium on height would tend to be predominantly male, even if selection is on a sex-blind basis. So how does this all play out in the workplace? The temperamental sex differences described can explain some patterns that are otherwise puzzling. Women's position in the workplace is an odd mosaic. By many measures, women have made astonishing progress in the last few decades. They comprise 46% of the American workforce and over 40% of all managerial positions in the workforce. They constitute about a quarter of all lawyers and physicians, and for those newly entering the professions, the numbers are much higher. Despite these striking advances, however, women are far from achieving parity in a number of areas. Many occupations remain highly sex segregated. Among the occupations in the US that remain 90% or more female are bank teller, receptionist, registered nurse, and kindergarten teacher. Among the occupations that are less than 10% female are engineer, firefighter, mechanic, and pest exterminator. Only 5 to 7% of senior executives in large corporations are women, a phenomenon commonly known as the glass ceiling. Also, full-time female employees earn only 75 cents for every dollar earned by female full-time male employees, an outcome labeled the gender gap in compensation. Although all these figures provided are from America, similar trends exist in other Western countries, although the numbers vary to some extent. Many assume that statistical disparities in the outcomes for the two sexes are necessarily caused by discrimination. Now, discrimination, of course, does exist, but the assumption that disparities prove it implicitly rests on the social science assumption of identity between the sexes. That is, it rests on a belief that left to choose freely without unfair employer bias, employees would sort themselves in a proportional way, that men and women are identical with respect to traits that are relevant to workplace outcomes. A list of the traits of successful top executives reads like a list of stereotypical male personality traits: aggressiveness, competitiveness, ambition, drive, and the willingness to take risks. These are characteristics not only of male executives, but also of female executives. Perhaps the defining feature of successful corporate executives is the willingness to take risks and the judgment and luck necessary to have those risks work out. It's probably not a coincidence that women tend disproportionately to occupy jobs with lower career risk, jobs in the public or nonprofit sectors, and within corporations, staff rather than operations positions. Operations positions, such as running a factory or running a division, entail higher career risk than staff positions because the positions are directly tied to the corporate bottom line. Success and failure are therefore generally quite obvious. Positions in operations are also typically prerequisites to advancement to the highest levels in corporations. The gender gap in compensation is also traceable in part to sex differences in temperament. Although it's widely asserted that the gap is primarily a consequence of wage discrimination, most economists who have studied the issue disagree. Men and women who do the same work, at least in the US, are generally compensated similarly. The sex differences exist among those doing the same work. Much of the difference is accounted for by differences in productivity-related factors, such as the number of hours worked. Much of the gap is due to the fact that men and women often do different work. Men tend to occupy the most dangerous jobs and jobs with the least pleasant working conditions. In the US, some 93% of all workers killed on the job are men. The most basic principles of economics dictate that, all else being equal, a risky or unpleasant job will have to pay more. Even within occupational fields, the sexes have somewhat different career orientations. Female physicians and lawyers, for example, are much more likely than their male counterparts to be employed for a salary and to work regular and shorter hours. Men are more likely to be in private practice, working longer hours and bearing the economic risk of business failure. The focus on the disproportionate representation of men at the highest level should not be allowed to obscure some important facts. On average, female jobs are rated as slightly higher in status than male jobs. And the very lowest status jobs also tend to be disproportionately male. It may also be worth noting that we have a social welfare program for men at the very bottom that also skews the statistics. We provide these men with food, clothing, lodging, and work, and though they don't earn much money, they aren't counted in the labor force, so they don't depress the male earning statistics. In the US, more than 1 million men take advantage of this benefit. We call it prison. In sum, people's preferences and temperamental predispositions have a substantial impact on the occupational choices they make and the extent to which they're willing to invest in their careers. Because these preferences and predispositions are not, on average, the same for men and women, the sexes do not occupy each workplace niche in equal proportions. I should emphasize that the foregoing argument is not a justification for discrimination, but rather an explanation for why, even in the absence of discrimination, different outcomes would be predicted. Does the argument presented here mean that women will be forever excluded from the executive suite? Not at all. The choice of the glass ceiling metaphor, while undoubtedly effective in catching the attention of the public, is unfortunate because it's fundamentally misleading. If there were a glass ceiling, it would keep all women out until the first woman went through, and then, after that, it wouldn't keep anyone out anymore. If that were what was going on, all the talk about shattering the glass ceiling might make some sense. But the glass ceiling is not a barrier at all. It is only a statistical abstraction. When will women reach the executive suites? The answer is that they are there already and in large numbers, at least in the United States. The current issue of Fortune magazine profiled the 50 most influential women in corporate America. These are incredibly successful women, mostly in their 40s and 50s, who are expected to go on to achieve even higher success. Is the representation of women in high positions today the maximum number that female biology is capable of achieving? The answer is, of course, no. The path to the executive suite takes decades, and those holding top positions today set out on a career path set decades ago when opportunities for women were restricted and women made their educational and occupational choices accordingly. As the corporate suites become increasingly populated by people who entered the labor force in the 1980s and 1990s rather than in the 1960s and 1970s, the number of women should continue to rise. On the other hand, for reasons that I've already described, it's unlikely that women will ever achieve parity at the highest levels, at least not in the absence of substantial governmental intervention. The same issue of Fortune magazine that I just mentioned profiled the women of the Harvard Business School class of 1983. Many of these women have been immensely successful, a number of them earning more than $1 million a year. On the other hand, about a third of them either work part-time or have left the labor force altogether, most to spend time with their families. Among those working full-time, a number report having made career compromises for family. Although the percentage of women attending the Harvard Business School increased dramatically from about 4% in 1973 to 26% in 1983, in the last 15 years, the percentage has been relatively stable. It hasn't increased. The glass ceiling metaphor is precisely backwards. It is meant to evoke an image of an impermeable but invisible barrier that holds women back. But women who make the same career choices as men can reach the corporate pinnacles, and many do. A more apt term is gossamer ceiling, which evokes just the opposite image. It's a barrier that women often see, but that is not strong enough to hold them back if they choose to take the steps necessary to cross it. Well, that's basically the short version of my very short book. But it leaves us with the question of what, if anything, we should do, and we meaning society, about the sex differences in workplace outcome that I've described. The science can tell us much about the psychologies of men and women and provide an explanation for what we see around us. But the science can only tell us the is and not the ought. In other words, it can tell us why we're here, but it does not necessarily tell us where to go from here, since the direction we decide to go is not a scientific issue, but rather a policy choice. That's not to say that the science is irrelevant to the policy discussion, however. The scientific evidence may properly influence people's views about whether anything ought to be done at all. Many people today believe that statistical disparities between the sexes should be eliminated not because they think disparities are evil in themselves, but rather because they think they're a consequence of improper discrimination. Thus, understanding the cause is relevant to, but does not determine the initial decision of whether to do anything at all. Excuse me. In many ways, the policy questions are stickier than the scientific questions. My explanation of the operation of sex differences in the workplace is either basically correct or basically incorrect. I won't ask for a show of hands. The question of what we ought to do, however, involves value judgments about which people may have basic philosophical disagreements. For example, assume that my explanation for why the average woman makes less than the average man is correct. Women work fewer hours, occupy safer jobs, and enjoy more pleasant working conditions. Should something be done about these average differences in compensation if we're convinced that they result from individual choices rather than systematic discrimination? The answer to that question turns to some extent on what view of equality one embraces. Those who adhere to the notion of equality of opportunity or equality of treatment might say that nothing need be done. Men and women are individually presented with a choice, and the fact that on average they make different choices is no basis for questioning or undoing the effects of that choice. On the other hand, those who adhere to the notion of equality of outcome or equality of result would say we do care if there are major differences between group outcomes, even if individuals are treated fairly. As long as women as a group occupy lower paid positions, women as a group suffer harm. It seems to me that science doesn't help us much in selecting between these two views. An accurate understanding of human psychology may be an important aid in helping us evaluate whether proposed policies are likely to have their intended effects. Hardly any discussion of the glass ceiling can proceed for long without someone blaming the relatively low number of women in the executive suites on the lack of subsidized daycare. However, the idea that increased daycare subsidies would substantially increase the number of female top executives is fundamentally flawed. Women who are potential CEOs and who leave the workforce to be with their children do not do so because they can't afford childcare. They are typically highly paid employees already. Instead, they leave because they feel a strong desire to be with their children, a predictable urge for a mammalian mother. As long as the motivating force for these women is to be with their children, large numbers are going to continue to leave the workforce, no matter how attractive the workplace is made for them. This is not to argue that subsidized daycare is a bad idea, but the primary beneficiaries would be lower income workers rather than potential CEOs. Another commonly advanced initiative is to make it easier for women to work part-time so they can more easily fit work to family. Many women, of course, do work part-time already. Whatever its other merits, this proposal, like the daycare proposal, is not a blueprint for increasing the status of women in the workplace. Part-time workers are not generally going to make it to the executive suites, and they are not generally going to earn as much as full-time workers. Ready availability of part-time work might actually increase the statistical disparities between the sexes, since the number of women moving from full-time work to part-time work may be greater than the number of non-working women who move into part-time work. Some have argued that men should be encouraged or even required to share equally the domestic chores of childcare and housework, on the theory that women's disproportionate burden at home prevents women from devoting as much energy to the workplace as men do. Apart from the obvious questions of personal liberty raised by the government's coming to view the domestic division of labor as part of the public business, there's an equally serious question whether such a move would even benefit women. For reasons understandable in evolutionary terms, men's self-esteem is more related to workplace success than is that of women, which is tied more to success in social, especially family relations. Of course, again, I'm talking about averages. Thus, the psychic rewards of both working and not working are often different for both men and women. Upsetting the balance that a given couple has reached is likely to cause psychic stress to everyone. Pressuring the man to trade extra domestic success, which is his primary source of self-esteem, for domestic contributions is likely to cause him to be less satisfied with both his job and his marriage. Similarly, pressuring women to seek and accept high-level positions to which they are not fully committed can lead to inadequate performance as well as unwanted stress. Some feminists have held up as a goal the complete elimination of the sexual division of labor. Half the homemakers will be women and half will be men, and as many men will be economically dependent on their wives as women will be dependent on their husbands. An understanding of human psychology suggests two things. First, this scenario is extraordinarily unlikely to occur. And second, most people in the non-traditional relationships would not prefer it to more traditional arrangements. Men's desire for status is a biologically ingrained one, as is the desire for men with high status. The notion that female executives and professionals would in large numbers be willing to marry men who would stay home and take care of the home and children is fanciful. Successful women not only want husbands who work, they, to a much greater extent than men, want mates who are also highly successful. There are undoubtedly some men who would be willing to play the role of house husband for highly successful women, but these are not likely to be men successful women would find desirable. Some propose that girls should be taught to be risk takers like boys. The problem with this suggestion is that it's much harder to modify temperament than it is to modify behavior. While one could teach girls to engage in more risk-taking behaviors, that's not the same as teaching them to enjoy taking risks. Boys don't take risks because they are told they should. They take risks because it brings them pleasure. Encouraging people who are basically risk-averse to increase their risk-taking behavior is a prescription, again, for psychic stress. One should also not ignore the downside of risk. The reason that risk-taking carries with it reward is that some risks don't work out. Thus, some number of the occupants of well-paying, dangerous jobs will end up with broken bodies for their troubles, and some number of risk-taking managers will end up as dismal failures. Thus, it should be understood that a policy of urging greater risk-taking in girls would leave some girls worse off than they otherwise would have been. Rather than trying to increase the risk-taking behavior of women, one might also consider decreasing the risk-taking behavior of men. Because men engage in riskier activities, more of them fail. Should society take greater steps to protect men from the consequences of their risky choices? That course would run the risk of neglecting the upside of risk. We all benefit because some people are willing to take risks that we ourselves would not take. Should we really begrudge these people their reward? Perhaps the most obvious thing that evolutionary science can tell us is that the terms of the debate should shift. Initiatives to achieve sexual parity in all spheres typically enjoy a strong presumption of moral authority because they're perceived as attempts to remedy arbitrary and unfair discrimination. Because of this special moral status, policy initiatives are often not subjected to the same kind of cost-benefit analysis that we ordinarily apply to policy questions, and substantial costs may therefore be incurred for misguided reasons. Excuse me. One concrete example of this is the current drive to open combat positions in the U.S. military to women. The Navy, for example, is under substantial pressure to train more female fighter pilots. These are among the highest status positions in the military, and the lack of women in these positions is viewed as an affront to equality. In some respects, of course, the dearth of female fighter pilots is clearly traceable to discrimination, since only in the last few years have women been allowed to occupy these jobs. The obvious history of formal exclusion, however, has resulted in neglect of the questions of how many women would hold these positions in the absence of discrimination and what the costs are of the current push for integration. There's reason to believe that sex-neutral selection would result in few female fighter pilots. There may be no task in the military that's more difficult than flying a carrier-based jet, and the skills that it requires are ones that men disproportionately possess, and even not very men possess them. It requires high technical competency and a willingness to expose oneself to risk just to fly the plane, particularly to make night landings. But air combat requires much more. It requires a high degree of what is called situational awareness, the ability to keep track of events and foresee occurrences in a fast-moving, dynamic, three-dimensional environment. Moreover, despite technical advances that often allow the pilot to fire on an enemy he can only see on a radar screen, the pilot can't count on this degree of separation, and he must be prepared to aggressively close with the enemy, as did pilots of the World Wars. Only the modern pilot must do it at a far higher speed. Unfortunately, the services have not yet devised a way to determine, prior to actual combat, who has the right stuff, though their failure is not for lack of trying. Because integration of women is viewed as a requirement of justice, fundamental questions have not been addressed in as serious a way as they should have been. The most fundamental question is whether military effectiveness is enhanced or diminished by these changes. No one suggests that female fighter pilots are better than male fighter pilots, and indeed few suggest that there are many female fighter pilots as good as the average male fighter pilot. In order to get women into the cockpit, the services have lowered the selection standards for women, although the military insists that all are highly qualified. Women graduates of the Naval Academy, for example, have sometimes been given the option of prestigious flying assignments that their class rank would not entitle them to. And it's widely perceived among male pilots that women are simply not allowed to fail in the rigorous flight training from which male aviators wash out regularly. This perception has led to substantial morale problems among male pilots and has led many of them to leave the service. These are costs that legitimately should be considered in the decision-making process. Finally, when speaking of the military, I think it's essential to raise a different kind of issue. So far tonight, I've been discussing individual traits, such as competitiveness, risk-taking, and so forth, that individuals of either sex might possess, but which are disproportionately possessed by one of the sexes. I've been careful to emphasize that while average differences between the group may explain disparities in representation, that's a far different thing from saying that differences justify different treatment of equally qualified individuals based upon sex. But focus on individuals and individual traits should not obscure the fact that humans are intensely social beings, and social interactions are often critical to the functioning of a group. Here I'm raising the question whether women can be fully integrated into military units, even if they as individuals possess the requisite traits of strength, physical courage, and so forth. Those advocating complete integration of women in combat units typically argue that if a woman has the requisite qualifications, she should be allowed to serve in combat if she wants. Notice that the demand is not really for full parity with men, which would require women to serve in combat if ordered. The assumption underlying this plea is that men and women are interchangeable as long as they possess the necessary qualifications. The primary obstacle to integration of women in the military under this view is attitudes of men operating at a cognitive level, that is, an ideology of the male warrior, an ideology that could be unlearned. It very well may be, however, that men have an innate predisposition to resist inclusion of women in groups that are organized for the purpose of warfare and other dangerous pursuits. Warfare is widely viewed as the quintessential manly pursuit and has often been the defining feature of masculinity for a culture. In many primitive societies, for example, a male is not entitled to full status as a man until he distinguished himself in warrior, usually by killing at least one enemy. Anthropologist Lionel Tiger has argued that the organization of cooperative groups for hunting or warfare may have resulted in substantial selective pressure for men to resist inclusion of women. Because in primitive societies, most adult females are pregnant or nursing most of the time, men who permitted women to join their ventures would be at a disadvantage. Women would be less valuable contributors, and their presence could disrupt the cooperative nature of the enterprise by generating competition for sexual access. This evolutionary history could account for the intensity of many men's emotional aversion to the introduction of women into combat units. The question whether the reluctance of men to welcome women warriors is ideologically based or a more fundamental product of male psychology is an important one. The standard social science approach is to assume that it is ideological and that men can be educated out of it. The argument that integration of women into combat positions compromises military readiness is usually dismissed as being, if true at all, true only in the transition period until male attitudes have been fully adjusted. However, if there's something inherent in male psychology that creates an emotional resistance to women soldiers, education is not likely to be effective and the transition period may never end. People's capacity to overcome their biologically based aversions through learning is limited. No amount of education, for example, is going to convince people that the smell of dung is lovely or that the appearance of a hideously deformed child is beautiful. Our minds are simply not that malleable. Thus, the origin of men's opposition to women in combat units is of fundamental importance to military manpower policy, but under the standard social science assumption, it's never even been questioned. Some have argued that we should not base law and policy on one or another specific view of human nature. I can hardly think of a more misguided sentiment. What, after all, is law but an attempt to shape human behavior? And what could be more essential to that enterprise than an understanding of the nature of the beast we are trying to control? We would think a zookeeper guilty of malpractice if he sought to treat all animals the same, rather than understanding the psychology, if you will, of each separate species. When one thinks about it, law often rests on an implicit view of human nature. And they should. Government programs designed to create incentives for some favored behavior are based on a belief that the incentive will increase the likelihood of that behavior. In behaviorist terms, the programs are based on a belief that a particular stimulus acting on a human organism will result in a predictable behavioral response. Such a prediction is impossible without at least an implicit theory of the mind. Similarly, much policy relating to sexual equality is based upon the standard social science assumption that humans possess a sexually monomorphic mind rather than, as argued here, somewhat divergent psychologies. The final thought I would like to leave you with tonight, and yes, I am going to finish, is that the question for policymakers is not whether they should base policy on a particular view of human nature, but rather it's a question of which view of human nature they should embrace. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kingsley Brown. Perhaps the exhortation to return to our hunter-gatherer laziness will settle all issues of the problem of the workplace one day. I'm going to ask Jeffrey Miller first to come up and respond. Before he actually speaks, I'm under heavy instructions here. I'm just a sort of an automaton, really. We're now, after he speaks, we're going to throw this open to the floor. There's a microphone downstairs, but not upstairs. When you speak, will you please, first of all, say who you are and where you're from, if you're affiliated to any kind of institution. Also, keep the microphone fairly close to your mouth. It doesn't work otherwise. If you're upstairs, you just have to shout. So, Jeffrey.
I think a lot of strong passions are bound to have been evoked by the talks today. Certainly as a workaholic, I found Colin's talk quite offensive. And some of you, no doubt, will have varying reactions to the other talks. What I want to emphasize is just that Darwinism is a very eclectic framework that can encompass many, many divergent views. And whatever your ideology is about a particular issue, there is a Darwinian perspective that you can develop. What we see today are three books on quite divergent topics, and there are many different Darwinian versions that could have been written of each book. There are many different Darwinisms you could apply to the issue of selection versus self-organization and development, or farming, or sexual equality in the workplace. If you're offended by what you've seen, then please write your different Darwinian version of it. And I just want to emphasize that this is really the only arena that I think is going to dominate 21st century sciences of human nature and policy. So if you want to be in the game, then this is the arena that you have to be in, but it's a very embracing, generous, eclectic arena, and whatever your background, it can accommodate it. I think really the main common threads through the books are clarity of thinking, clarity of expression, and interdisciplinarity. And in that sense, I think modern Darwinian scholarship is really an example that all of the sciences should emulate.
Thanks. Well, we'll now... So, the discussion is open. Who would like to start? There's a gentleman down here. Take the microphone first.
To Kingsley Brown, please. How can you outline a mechanism whereby a group of combat troops will have their genetic fitness reduced by having a woman included? How do you, that idea that somehow men have got an inherent aversion to having females in a group, how can you explain that on a Darwinian basis, please?
Well, it would be on two levels. One is I'm not saying that I'm convinced that it exists. I'm saying that I think that there's a substantial enough reason that it ought to be considered by policymakers when they're thinking about the inclusion of women. The selective mechanism is one that, as I mentioned, Lionel Tiger described some years ago, and that is that men who welcomed women into these dangerous enterprises, such as the warfare that primitive tribes engage in with such frequency, that the fitness of the men who welcomed the women in would be substantially reduced because, one, if the women are their mates or potential mates and risk being excluded, and also the effectiveness of the group could be diminished because either of lesser overall average competence if the women were in fact nursing or pregnant as most women are in primitive societies, and also because they can disrupt the cohesion of the group by enhancing the competition among males for sexual access. As I say, I'm not. My point here was less to say that this is in fact the case. I'm not sure if it is, but I think that a Darwinian perspective should make people concerned about it. Because one of the things that you see, and this isn't, it's not always a hallmark of a naturally selected psychological mechanism, but the question of introduction of women into combat units creates an intense emotional reaction among male combat troops. It's often the case that strong emotions are related to behaviors that have been of importance evolutionarily, even if you can't, on a cognitive level, explain it. Some of the explanations that men in combat units give for excluding women are quite bizarre. One of the famous ones is, well, women shouldn't serve in combat because, after all, they menstruate, and so they'd have all these problems. Now, I can't really believe that there's a single person who thinks that that's the reason that women should be excluded from combat. But people do have these strong emotions, and the question, what you'd have to know if you're concerned with having the military work effectively, is, are these emotions, is this something that men can be taught out of, or is it something that's going to persist regardless of training because it is something that's part of the male psyche? And I think it's an important question that I don't think that the military has really looked at.
Hello. Am I using this one? Yes. All right.
Angela Franklin. I almost regret to say that the last speech had persuaded me quite well on a lot of things, which I pra- perhaps I'm reluctant to accept, but maybe I do now. But there is one thing I don't think really follows in your argument. You are very reluctant, as you said, to... you say, why should we begrudge the men who take the risks and so on extra reward? But that's looking at some... This isn't working, is it? That's looking at it from just a one-sided view. The women might say, I'm not prepared to take that risk. I don't want all that competition. And therefore, perhaps, yes, they should be paid more. They should have higher reward. But why couldn't we look at it from the other point of view, from the men's point of view, and say, we like risk, we want competition, we want to get out and about. If they're prepared to do the humdrum, so-called jobs, or even prepared to spend half their time at home talking to two-year-olds, why can't the men say, surely they deserve more money if they're prepared to do that?
Okay, there are a couple points in there. The first is that men enjoy taking risks, but typically risks with a particular payoff. That is, men are willing to exchange a risk of death for something else. It may be purely status. It might be some sort of wealth. The fact is, one of the things that you see if you look at the labor market and how wages are determined, that in fact, I mean, employers aren't stupid. And they are greedy, not to be too judgmental, but they are acting in their own economic interests. They don't pay men more to do these jobs that are risky because they think, although we could get them for less, we'll give them a little bit more just because we think risk is neat. Basically, you do have to provide people more money generally to take jobs that are risky. As to the question of compensating women for staying home with the children, which I think was the second part of the equation. The question is, who's going to do the compensating? You know, the employer is not going to. The employer pays people to do work for it, rather than to pay people to stay home and do work for themselves. Whether there should be some sort of social policy that says, you know, we pay, as some countries in Europe now do, that pay money for women who stay home with their children. That's a completely separate issue. I mean, I think that it's not one that the Darwinian viewpoint says a whole lot about. It's really a social policy issue.
Oliver Curry, LSE. I'd just like to ask all the panel, in the light of Colin and King's talks, what they think the chances are of convincing men to be lazier. To be lazier.
It's quite striking if you travel outside the Western world and take a vacation practically anywhere that's, quote, underdeveloped, how little the men actually do, and how the vast majority of economic activity and support of the family is the burden of women. I mean, in Morocco, if you get up at 6 a.m. and take a walk around the hills, you see the men sleeping in their tents and the women carrying the firewood around. And that's bog standard. I suspect that that's sort of the human norm and that is the way things were mostly in the Pleistocene. And what the men did was they engaged in their little risky status games for a few hours a week doing their hunting or whatever. But the view that they were breadwinners working 60 hours a week is, I agree with Colin there, that's an artifact of agriculture and modern capitalism. So I don't actually think it would be that hard.
Yeah. It actually strikes me that the chances of persuading people to do things differently are actually quite low because we're so sort of hooked into an economy in which it seems to me the chances of changing people radically are quite low because we're hooked into an economy which demands that you work harder and harder and harder. I don't quite see how you get out of that. On the other hand, if it's true, as Jeffrey says, and I think it is true, that the Darwinian thinking is going to take off in the 21st century and people start taking human nature seriously and start looking at it more carefully, and that these ideas start filtering in, then at least the idea of being lazy might become respectable. I mean, I think it's quite interesting, actually, that the things we now call leisure, we then attach the word industry at the end, don't we? The leisure, the football industry, you know, and all that's quite extraordinary, really.
No, I don't think I have any comment except that I was sympathetic to Colin's remarks about farming, because I remember deciding very early in my life that I wasn't going to get into farming. It looked too much like hard work. But I don't seem to have done any better.
If I could just make one comment, and that is that one of the main reasons that people work so hard in today's corporate world is because it's a way of achieving status. You don't have to do that in other cultures. You can, as Jeffrey says, spend a couple hours a week in your status displays, and people are lazy. I mean, that's one of Colin's central insights. You don't do more than you have to. So you stop at a point in which there's no longer a reward for your activity. In the corporate world, the stopping point is fairly high. There is a stopping point. It's called insanity, I think. But it's fairly high. Now you could do things to put a maximum number on the hours you can work or how much you can make, beyond which you get no reward. That obviously may have some of its own economic problems, but that would, in some respects, people don't keep working when they have no reason to.
Phil Ramsden from Imperial College. As a left-wing Darwinist, I guess I'm most exercised by some of the things Kingsley had to say, but I've got a feeling that a number of people are going to pick you up on those. So I'd like to direct my question to John Maynard Smith. I am a mathematician. My background is in dynamical systems, and I've always been rather puzzled about why it seems to be that the people who are talking about self-organization as part of the explanation for patterns that we see in development, some of them anyway, talk in terms of this as if it were an alternative to an explanation in terms of natural selection, and perhaps even inimical to or a competitor with such a Darwinian account of development, whereas it's always seemed to me that it's answering, if you like, a different set of questions and providing a different angle on the matter. Why do you feel that this idea has grown up that a self-organization account of development is in some sense opposed to a natural selection account of development?
Well, let me say first of all, I'm convinced. Is this making a noise? Am I audible?
Just about.
I think any satisfactory explanation of development is certainly going to require the development, the genetic aspect. But after all, genes have their effects through the laws of physics and chemistry. I mean, they do so by determining the rates of reaction of enzymes and things of that kind. So certainly we're going to need some dynamics. I think the reason why people in dynamic systems sometimes, and actually more often than they should, it seems to me, want to get away from any genetic involvement and suggest they have an alternative explanation is that genetic explanations, when you go into them, are nauseatingly complicated. They really are. There's a paper this week, I picked it up at breakfast this morning, on how flower development, the next stage in understanding flower development. It would take me a couple of hours to remember which gene was doing what and switching which one off and which one on and so on. I mean, I'm not saying the paper's wrong. What I'm saying is it's hard work understanding it, even harder work remembering it and so on. If you could just write down a partial differential equation, and you like them, which I do on the whole, how easy. I mean, I could remember as a young man being obsessed by Turing's ideas, the idea of wave formation and so on, and I saw waves all around me, you know, in zebras and so on, and flower petals for that matter. The beauty of those ideas was that they were simple. Given that you're prepared to accept that the actual mathematics may be a bit elaborate, the rules that go in are jolly simple. I mean, they're just simply the laws of chemical reaction and diffusion. Whereas if that is not the kind of explanation you want. If you want a sort of detailed gene-by-gene explanation, it's messy. So I think fundamentally the motive behind the sort of self-organization, let's forget about genetics movement, is, well, it's laziness, which I suppose the other two people on the candidate on the panel are in favor of. You know, that's too damn lazy to understand the genetics.
I would like the days of atomic psychology to be dead, over, done with, and put to rest forever. I have heard you appeal to atomic psychology without any appeal to family psychology. My name is Huxley, I'm an anthropologist. And it disagrees with my grain and the grain of everyone I know who has ever been in psychological, domestic, emotional troubles to have the Oedipal finger pointed at them and say, you're Oedipal. It doesn't work like that. The Oedipus complex, which was Freud's great non-contribution to our society, if you remember when he went to America in the company of Jung, he told Jung, we are bringing them the plague. By God, has he brought them the plague? Has he left the plague with us of considering that we are only individuals without a family tradition and without family responsibility?
Could you bring this to the focus of a question? Because there are a lot of us here with lots to say.
Well, I'm sure, and so do I. And I don't think that the days of atomic psychology have anything to do with our future and have very little to do with our past. Unless we bring in the fact that we have grandparents as well as parents, as well as children, as well as grandchildren, that the whole thing works in, we have to consider three generations before we can consider even ourselves. I don't think that this argument about evolution, Darwin, natural selection, is going to hold water.
Colin, would you like to respond?
Not much. What about Jeff?
I work in a center that does evolutionary game theory, where the focus is entirely on social interaction and modeling social interaction. One of the books, which unfortunately couldn't be represented by the author here, is about step-parents and families, and is an explicit Darwinian analysis of family dynamics that gets away from Freud. There are textbooks out on evolutionary social psychology. There are lots and lots of books on family dynamics from an evolutionary viewpoint. And so I think the best enemy of what you call atomic psychology at present is Darwinian psychology.
Yeah. Can I just add to that, I remember not very long ago writing a paper entitled The Evolution of Parental Care, in which, in fact, precisely the issue I was interested in, not only in humans but in animals in general, as to why particular patterns of parental care, male care, female care, biparental care, and so on, evolved and in what circumstances and so on. And if Darwinism isn't concerned with family, what is it concerned with? I mean, forget your own life, you just have lots of kids, you know.
And look after them. All right, okay, sorry. Next time round. Gentlemen, hand up.
Thank you. Being a reductionist like Maynard Smith, I'd like to propose that probably the basic difference between sort of human evolution and natural evolution is in the fact that with natural selection it is more or less accidental, but with human evolution there is the problem of human agency. Now there's a lot of work in social sciences done on human agency. However, where there's a defect there too, is that the human agency is really individual specific. In other words, social scientists haven't yet enough explored the problem of group agency action and its effect on evolution. I don't know if neo-Darwinists have done enough work on this problem. What I wanted to ask Maynard Smith and the panel is this. In terms of the 21st century and the intellectual agenda setting, there is obviously a scientific mafia in terms of publishing, lecturing, and so on and so forth. How does this scientific mafia affect the evolutionary, intellectual evolutionary development? And is it time that one tries and either through evolutionary methods fight the mafia or let it take its course? I mean, I would like to know what your opinions about this is.
Well, I suppose I'm a member of the mafia, is that right? I mean, let's face it, the thing to do with the mafia is to attack it. If you think that any intellectual doctrine is acquiring excessive power in any field, even if it's got a lot of the truth, you've got to attack it. But the thing that's worrying is there seem to be fewer and fewer publishing houses, fewer and fewer newspapers, and so on. The internet is probably our saving grace. More opportunities for saying what you think. Because other than the internet, it seems to me that there's more and more monopoly on the possibilities of publishing, which is dangerous.
But should people like you be fighting the mafia from inside?
Oh, that the Almighty had not set his canon against self-slaughter.
Can I take this lady here with the white sweater?
Well, as you know, there's a raging debate about whether race really is anything or not. Fortunately, I think most of us are beyond the point where we might argue about whether sex is really something or not. If the question is everything that I say about sex equally relevant to race, the answer is no, that natural selection has clearly operated most strongly with respect to reproductive success on sex differences, much more so than on racial differences. Now, if you're arguing, if you're saying, suppose that you could demonstrate that there were, in fact, biological differences between racial groups or among racial groups, in which you could, again, demonstrate differences in aptitude, in inclination, or whatever, would the form of my argument apply equally well? And I would say yes, that you can't assume that the current assumption would be that it's discrimination. That assumes basically equal qualifications, equal interest, and so forth. But that would be based upon a factual showing that I think has yet to be made and may never be made. So I would say that that's the difference between race and sex.
We'll take another question from the balcony. It's the neglect. Take the lady from the bank.
I'm going to repeat the question as best I can. If indeed we have been proto-farmers since a very, very early stage, doesn't this rather negate the perceived differences between men and women, since it's pretty obvious that in primitive so-called farming societies, men and women share the work more or less equally, in fact, women do most of it, and Well, my answer to that is I don't think it does. I think it's quite important that women do a lot of work in agriculture because I think one of the points is that when we were proto-farmers, we were mixing agriculture with hunting and gathering more or less equally, or one doesn't have to say equally. Very, very interesting studies, I think actually quite seminal studies, which not many people know about, by a chap called John Yellen, who looked at Hottentots in the 1960s, and he discovered that Hottentots were perfectly good at agriculture, and they sometimes kept goats, and they sometimes grew things. But every now and again, they decided they didn't want to anymore, and they simply got rid of the goats, and they stopped growing things, and they went back to being hunting. And what he pointed out was that the idea that there was a kind of eureka moment when people who had been hunting suddenly discovered farming and then said, whoopee, this is terrific, let's do this instead, was simply not true. And he envisages a state in which people, through most of their history probably, were mixing a bit of husbandry with a lot of hunting. So I think it's quite likely, if you see that becomes incredibly powerful, actually. And as I said, if you're a farmer, you are, in fact, a much more effective hunter because you're no longer dependent on your prey base. And what I would have envisaged, which seems to be perfectly plausible, is that if you're mixing the two things, indeed the women would do most of the work on the farming, which in its early stages would be horticulture rather than arable. And the chaps would be out, they would be out hunting, just as they always were. So it seems.
Can I remind you that there was this second problem you had 15 years ago, how the brain affects behaviour? The first one did done quite well in the period. We're going to come up for this problem because brain-affected behaviour is going to be important for Darwinian explanations because although you build this wonderful machine with genes, it then very much complicatedly affects our behaviour, and if we're going to try to explain it, we have to keep understanding how our brains and why our brains are doing the complicated things they are. What do you reckon the time course for that one will be as we get into more sophisticated explanations for genes into behaviour through brain?
I'm real sorry, I'm going to opt out of that one. I don't understand neurobiology. I certainly don't understand psychology to any considerable extent. So I simply don't have an informative prediction. I'm sorry.
Seems to be one microphone much better than the other. Can we just not use the one that's so appalling? Or is it just an illusion that there are two? Some people have the knack, perhaps.
I'm Amy Parrish from University College London, and my comments are actually for Kingsley Brown. I'll try to keep them limited. I think I'll take Jeffrey up on his challenge that if you're offended, then you can write your different Darwinian version of it. And I would comment that a different Darwinian version has been written, one that's based on data, and one that's convincing, and one that's very important to cite, and that involves work from Barbara Smuts, from Sarah Hurdy, from Patty Gawati, from a number of scientists that are very important in the field of animal behavior. For instance, we can look at something like paternal investment. I think for a number of species, especially humans, that's been overrated, and we can show that quantitatively in studies from Kristen Hawkes, for instance, who showed that hunters don't use the meat that they catch or that they kill to provision their families, but rather spread it around to potential mates, and hence it's not paternal investment that's driving hunting, but rather mate choice. In fact, hunters don't stop hunting, and in that sense working, when there's no reason to, but instead it's the best hunters that do the most hunting simply because they can attract more mates. And in fact, good hunters are more often named as fathers of illegitimate children in the village. And overall, I think it's been pretty well shown that for a number of human species, mate choice is what's driving what had been traditionally called paternal investment. And then I'd just like to say one other thing, which is you can look at something like the Fortune 500 magazine portrayal of 50
female executives, but you can compare that with a Vanity Fair portrayal of the top 50 IT information technology executives, which contained one female. And I think just quoting 50 female executives in America gives no idea of what proportion they're occupying in population.
I really don't have any quarrel with much of what you said. With respect to the payoff for being a good hunter. I mean, essentially, I think that's consistent with what I had said. With respect to the Fortune magazine thing, my point there was not to suggest that there were equal proportions of men and women. The statistic that I gave out at the beginning of my talk was that women were approximately 5 to 7% of top executives in major corporations. It was really to make the point that sometimes gets lost that there's this notion, because of the metaphor of the glass ceiling, that no women advance beyond a particular point. And the fact is that they do, that some women do, and some women are highly successful in the business world. And the glass ceiling really reflects not a complete barrier to women, but rather what you're talking about, I think, which is a disproportion of men at the top levels. And as I said, I predict that even in the absence of affirmative action and what you call positive discrimination here, that the number of women in the top positions will continue to increase for the reasons that I said. I'm not suggesting that this is sort of the place we end up.
I think it is important for more people to read about these issues of paternal investment versus courtship display as driving male work patterns. And I think the anthropological and primatological evidence does suggest that Amy's right. And what this means is that it gives women a very powerful argument against their male workaholic partners. It means they can say, what are you doing? Because we know from anthropology it's not really about my kids. It's about extra pair of matings. It's about display. You've already got me. Why are you still displaying? So that cuts both ways. And I think, you know, the implications of this don't come with their political bias pre-attached. You can give any of these facts a whole range of political interpretation. And we should be as imaginative as possible in coming up with them.
Take this gentleman at the end here.
My name's Mike Phillips. I'm literally somebody who's just wandered in from the street not knowing your debate was taking place, which I regret in a way because I think this is extremely important. I'd like to have prepared. I mean, Ian McEwan began by saying that this represents an incursion into the social sciences of paleontology, genetics, and so on. But I think in some ways this is also true the other way around. I'd read the other day in The Guardian about part of the debate that Kingsley Brown has provoked. And being somebody who works in office, I'm a civil servant, I can say that these ideas, especially in a place like the LSE, are not just relevant from a scientific point of view, but they are used by the so-called elite that somebody referred to earlier on to put forward their point of views. Now, I admit to being political myself, but I think that obviously it's important to have a debate and look at what's the truth. I'd like to ask just one or two quick questions to the panel generally, but firstly just to address John Maynard-Smith.
If you could just ask one question, because we've got an awful lot of people pushing behind you. We've only got a quarter of an hour left.
Certainly. Okay,
just
then.
One question.
Okay, well, to John Maynard-Smith then. Are you arguing, John, that the idea of biological potentiality, which is the idea that we're not determined necessarily by our genes or by a social history, but that there's a sort of a limit, this is an idea obviously Stephen Jay Gould has argued, but are you arguing that biological potentiality can both embrace molecular reductionism, as you call it, and holism at the same time, that it's not necessarily a contradiction, and that the behaviour of people can be largely explained by political and social background? For example, the position of women in society, I would argue, can be explained simply by going back 40,000 years, but it's been the events of the last few thousand years which have had a particular impact and the social construction of what is it that women do, particularly in the post-war era. And I think it's oversimplistic to perhaps use biology as an explanation. Just finishing, would you agree, and addressing John Maynard Smith again, that I've lost my place here, but okay, under pressure. Man from the streets have said.
Thank you. John, would you respond to that?
Well, I find it difficult to give a succinct answer to that. But look, I mean, I agree. If somebody comes along and says that, you know, all human behavior is genetically determined, all differences between human behavior is genetically determined, that if I like spending my day doing sums and you'd prefer to spend your day painting pictures, it must be in our genes. Manifestly, that kind of genetic determination is rubbish. But equally, if somebody comes along and says human beings are a tabula rasa upon which experience can write what it will, all human beings are created equal, assertion made only, as far as I know, really in the American Constitution, that we all can do anything, whatever we like, it seems to me that is equally manifestly rubbish. I'm sorry, but the world is a complicated place, and if you want to understand the kind of issues to do with sexual differentiation at work, for example, you have to take into account the social conditions under which families live, the kind of education that girls are given, which isn't the same as boys, and so on. But you also have to take into account many millions of years of evolution in which males and females have been exposed to different selection pressures. And if any profession which left either one or the other of those facts out of account is simply being stupid, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Take this lady.
Brenda Maddox, I'm a writer. To Kingsley Brown, aren't the policy implications of what you said, that women shouldn't be in the military and the military just reduces its effectiveness by taking them in?
I'm saying that there's reason to think that may be the case. With respect to the issue of the disruption of cohesion that I was talking about, I think that's an important question. I don't think it's resolved, but the problem is that the military is not looking into it. I think that the implication, of course, is never, I think, simply from a description of a certain set of facts that a certain policy necessarily follows. There are people, there are a number of feminists in the United States who would say that female equality trumps military effectiveness. So even if the introduction of women actually diminishes military effectiveness, we're a strong country. We're not going to probably lose any wars just because we lose a bit of military effectiveness. We may lose a few more soldiers, but that's really a policy question that the science doesn't tell you. But I think that the science should tell people, the military, people who are trying to decide what military manpower policy ought to be, that they ought to get real about sex differences between men and women and not simply assume that they're interchangeable the way they have so far.
I'm just going to use my privileged position to ask my own question of Kingsley, and that's this. Two separate wings of Darwinian thought really bearing on your thesis. Much do you make in your book of the essentially competitive nature of men and the essentially cooperative nature of women. Now, there's been quite a lot of work done on trade and amongst economists on capitalism, saying that it's wrong to see trade and capitalism entirely in terms of aggressive competitiveness. In fact, a very strong element of it is its cooperativeness. Could one not predict, therefore, because prediction from the theory is I think, key to what you're trying to argue, that women would be actually as essentially cooperative, if we took that biological view of them, well-suited to run corporations that need to flourish by cooperating with other corporations?
Well, I think one of the problems with that kind of point is that it tends to view cooperation and competition as just two completely separate things, that you're either a cooperator or you're a competitor. It is in fact true that trade requires a great deal of cooperation, but there's also a great deal of competition in trade, as anybody who's ever been in business knows. With respect, for example, to corporate hierarchies, where if we're talking about who's going to be the CEO, there's one spot, and there are a whole bunch of people who want it. And there's no real way that they can just cooperate and decide to share it, you know, among 20 or 25 people. So in the nature of a corporation, a hierarchical structure with a pyramid shape, I think it necessarily entails a degree of competition. And one of the things that some of the studies on male coalitions show is that males are very good at shifting back and forth between competition and cooperation. They cooperate when it's in their interest, and they can cooperate quite well with people they dislike. And when it's in their interest, they stop cooperating and they start competing. I don't think you choose one strategy or the other. I think it's a blend of the two.
Yeah. Just very quickly, it often strikes me that the psychology of hunting groups, which is to me essentially the same as the psychology of combat groups, is extremely interesting and seems to me to be rather understudied. I mean, one of the points is, if you do an optimum foraging strategy on hunting, you can show that it pays a hunter to kill an animal which is roughly its own size, because if it's smaller, it's not worth killing, and if it's bigger, it's too risky. But human beings sort of break this rule, and they're very good at killing things like elephants and rhinoceroses and giraffes and all that kind of stuff. And they do that by extreme cooperation. I mean, the chaps go out into the field and they rely entirely on each other's contribution in order to survive at all. And here you have an extreme degree of cooperation. And this is actually fundamental to the whole business of being a hunter.
Can I take a question from the balcony? We're rather neglecting you up there again. I'm sorry. Oh, there isn't one. You have to be quick. So I'll take someone who hasn't asked a question. This gentleman down here.
Thank you. My name is Duncan Butlin, and I'm an amateur sociobiologist. My question is for Ian McEwan. I would suggest that you're fooling yourself when you give the general impression of progress since Darwin on this key issue of Kingsley Brown's, basically the advice you give the general public, the way you help the general public distinguish between the sexes. I think that Darwin didn't question the differences, but that today we've gone so far as to deny them in public, and we have policies in our schools to get rid of them if they should surface. And we come, if we read Kingsley Brown's introduction, we come to this extraordinary statement describing his theories that there are innate differences as provoking and controversial. I think Darwin would just laughed. I think he would have said, "You haven't listened to me. You've gone backwards since I wrote my books."
I'm not sure if this is a question for me. Does science advance? Is this the basis of what you're saying?
No. I'm just saying, on this specific issue of advising the public on sex differences, that you've actually gone backwards. I would actually say,
well, I'm not aware of having advised the public on sex differences.
Darwin in his books did address it quite frequently.
Well, he wrote about sexual selection, which I think was a rather slightly different matter.
He never fought shy of saying women in general in certain instances and men in general.
Right.
Whereas it now is a very provoking and controversial view to suggest that women in general and men in general.
Oh, I think it is controversial only against the standard social science model, which, as I said in my introduction, seems to be under heavy attack.
Yes, but they're winning.
Are they? I think we've got them
policy
on the run, actually. I think not
if you look at the social policy in our schools.
Oh, yeah, but that's because they've had control for so long. I think the arguments are shifting, but they'll take a generation to shift. I think this will shift over 30 years, and I don't think any of us here know which direction it could take. These orthodoxies have been in place a long time, and the professoriat has been in control a long time. But I think it is shifting. But who knows? I mean, who can tell the future? And we shouldn't be too optimistic. It could all swing back the other way, and we'll all be an environmental determinist tomorrow. We are coming towards the end. I'm going to take this question from this lady over on the right. And this will be our last question.
My name is Diane Ziegler, and my affiliation is that my two-year-old ran into another two-year-old in the park, and we started talking about Darwinism with the two-year-old's mother. I don't think we have to worry about the lazy men theory, because all of the data that we have, if you include all labor, not just capitalistic labor, shows that women work far more many hours in a day than men do. And I think that's one criticism of what you're doing, is that you're only looking at paid labor, whereas I don't think Darwin has broke out capitalistic labor from other forms of labor. But my real question is very simple, is that right now 40% of the businesses in the US are owned by women. Women are starting more businesses at a rate of 2 to 1 per men as we speak in the US. How does that, these statistics are from the Small Business Administration on the website, how does that fit in with your theory that women are risk adverse, and wouldn't that lead to the fact that women are in fact facing discrimination in corporations as they're rapidly leaving corporations, and well, they might not have upwardly mobile jobs as you described, they certainly have secure positions, yet they're giving up these secure positions to start their own businesses, which is definitely a high risk proposition.
Well, different kinds of businesses present different kinds of risks. A lot of this, there are quite a number of small businesses being started by women that range from the sort of standard entrepreneurial kind of startup company to what really amounts to a part-time job. There are a lot of women-owned businesses that have been set up for no reason other than the fact that the federal government gives a bonus to women-owned businesses. So I think you have to look really beyond the statistics. If you look at the remuneration to female business owners, you see that they earn substantially less than male business owners, and the statistics are hard to get. But that appears to include, one of the reasons that they might be different, of course, is that men's business has been around for a lot longer. But I believe that even when it's held constant for how long the businesses have been in place, that you still see substantial differences between the income of males and the income of females. And I would guess, although this is just a guess, but you'd also have to look at the question of you know, how many hours the business owners are working. I've never suggested that women don't take risks. I've never suggested that some women aren't competitive. But the question is really one of group differences.
Yeah. Just in case there's a misunderstanding of the Darwinian position on this, I just wanted to make some sort of rather personal remarks about the problem of the differences between men and women in work. And I mean, the first thing that I have to say, I'm a lot older than most of you, there have been really very dramatic differences in the kinds of jobs that women can do and are doing today from what the situation was when I was young. And I regard those changes as wholly desirable. And listening to the discussion of the role of women in the military forces, you have the wrong Maynard Smith on the platform. The person who ought to be up here is not actually my wife, but my sister, who escaped from an upbringing in which she was supposed that the only thing she had to do in life was to marry, and that did not require an education. She had to marry well, and that was all. Escaped from that to spend the war driving a truck around North Africa. And I'll bet she drove the truck a great deal better than I would have done. I believe that there are statistical differences in between what men and women on average want to do. But let's, for goodness sake, not forget that, you know, in the last 50 years, the opportunities open to women have increased, and those who want to take those opportunities have taken them. And I hope we will, I don't think we've got equality in opportunity yet. And I'm sure that Dr. Brown doesn't either. I mean, there's still further purely social things we have to do. I don't want to see Darwinists lumbered with the notion that we are against these changes or think them impossible or don't want to see a greater equality of opportunity for peoples of either of different sex or of different race or of different anything else.
At the risk of trying to one-up Professor Maynard Smith, my mother was in the Navy during World War II also.
Well, there we are. A very typical piece of male one-upmanship to conclude the evening. I'd like really to give the last word to Gloria Steinem. I think she spoke most memorably about work when she said she could think of very few jobs in the world that required the possession of a penis to be able to do them. And it's something of a good parlor game to play, to think just what those jobs might be. Even male prostitution doesn't take you all the way. I'm asked to present as thanks from the organizers of this meeting a little gift. I asked them not to open it on the platform. It might embarrass them. It would embarrass me, rather. I have to...
Odd man out. I think there's a statement here.
Even Kingsley gets one. I have to thank our sponsors, Stickhead and Damon DeLazio, for their help with this event, and to thank Kingsley Brown, Colin Tudge, John Maynard Smith, and Jeffrey Miller, and also to say... Oh, I've got a present for myself. That's right. I have to hold it aloft so that you knew that I had a present. I get the most expensive present, mapping the mind. And to tell you that there is a launch party for Darwinism today. The books are on sale, too. The party is in the Student Cafe in the East Building on the opposite side of Houghton Street. Stewards will help you find your way there, and there are also signs. You're probably sitting on details about the books in the Darwinism Today series, as well as instructions on how to get to the Student Cafe. Snacks and drinks, and our distinguished authors will be very happy to sign books. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you, our speakers.